Hello, I'm Amelia Lush, Head of Children's and Young Adult Programs for Sydney Writers Festival. The conversation you're about to listen to was scheduled to take place live on stage at the 2020 Festival's All Day YA. First published as a teenager, English author and artist Alice Osman has grown up alongside her readers. Her heartfelt stories of fandoms, friendship and love have truly resonated with her young audience. In this conversation, Alice is joined by Jess Layton to discuss her comic series, Heartstopper, and her new novel, Loveless, her most personal work yet.
G'day, and welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival All Day YA podcast. I want to kick off today by acknowledging the ancestral lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land of which these events will ordinarily take place. I want to also acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional owners of the land where I am based here in Naarm. Aboriginal Australians are some of the oldest storytellers in our living human history. I want to pay my respects to their past and present elders and extend my recognition to their descendants who may be listening to this podcast. Australia has been and always will be Aboriginal land. Now, to put a name to that disembodied voice, I'm Jess Layton. I'm an Australian author, artist, and overall geek, and I'm so excited to be joined today by Alice Osman, who is a British author and illustrator of young adult fiction and graphic novels, including her most recent YA novel, Loveless, and her graphic novel series, Heartstopper. Welcome, Alice.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
Yes, how are you liking Australia?
So nice. No, I'm sad. I'm sad we couldn't meet in person, but this is great. We still get to do our event. Yeah.
I'm so excited that we get to chat today, especially about your, as of this moment, very, very recent release, Loveless.
Yeah. Must be out like nearly two weeks now it's been out.
It's not actually out here in Australia yet, so we're...
No, it's not.
We're waiting a little bit. I felt very lucky when I received an early copy and just ravenous for it, just ate it up instantly. So I think that's a really good place for sort of to start with this conversation about your craft and your writing is to talk a bit about Loveless. And from all the sort of press about Loveless and things, it's sort of come to known that it reflects your own experience as an Aero-Ace author. I was wondering, could you sort of go into a bit more, like how did you draw upon your own experiences specifically for Georgia's character?
So Georgia, to go back to basics, Georgia is aromantic asexual, and that's something that she comes to discover about herself in the book. And it's quite a difficult process for her. And that's sort of that's what I started with when I wanted to come up with Loveless. I wanted it to be a coming out novel, basically, because we all know about coming out novels, classic sort of gay YA stuff like Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda. That's a very classic coming out novel. But I'd never really read something like that about the aromantic and or asexual experience. There's been lots of YA that have asexual and aromantic characters, but I haven't read as many that really focus on that experience of like discovering that about yourself. So that's what I wanted to write. And Georgia, although it's not like an autobiographical story, her experience is very much based on my experience and how, you know, how I feel about my identity and how I figured it out. And
And I think it is, it's really telling that you can sort of see that it is an own voices story as an aromantic reader and writer as well. I can really see the parts of Georgia that reflect my own experience, like not discovering aromanticism or asexuality until in university, which is for YA specifically, it's not a common coming out story. So I think Loveless feeds into that idea of turning the head on the normal milestones people sort of assume, which has really been awesome because there has been an emergence of own voices stories like Loveless. So Loveless being an own voices story, how have you felt any sort of reception from that?
Yeah, I think people have really been enjoying the fact that it's own voices, purely because there aren't a lot of own voices ROA stories out there. The reception has been really good. People have been saying that it feels very true to their experience. But at the same time, like, I'm also very aware that it is just like one experience. There's so many different ways that people can experience being aromantic or asexual. It's like this book, no book can explore all of the spectrum, but you know, people have still been able to really connect to it, so that's been really nice.
And you do see that with the characters of Sunil and Jess, who I'm totally claiming as my own, by the way. There really is that exploration of love and loveless. It's certainly not a story without love, as the title may suggest. It's just full of that in-depth look into love through Shakespeare of all things, which is incredible. I'm sort of wondering that, so it's interesting because of YA, it's so much of YA is anchored in romance and is anchored in that idea of romantic love. I'm wondering if you could speak to how you sort of navigated that decision to prioritize platonic love, or why do you even think that so much of YA is anchored in that romantic love in the first place?
I mean, my books have always been very much centered on platonic relationships, even way back in Solitaire, you know, when I didn't even know that I wasn't straight. like
those days we didn't know.
I think that's just something that's always been a part of the stories that I want to tell and what I enjoy reading about, because for me, like, platonic relationships are some of the most important relationships in my life. And like, I have nothing against romance. Like, I love a good romance. And I totally understand why romance is so popular and why, because people, you know, particularly teenagers, I think really want to escape into a story that's fun and that you can obsess over, and it's so easy to do that with a romance, but it's a lot less common to see that with a book focused on platonic relationships. So with all my books, particularly Loveless, but also all of them really, like Radio Silence, there's, you've got this friendship at the heart of it between Alad and Francis, and in I Was Born for This you've got the friendship of Angel and Juliet, and then you've got the friendship of the boy band. Like, all my books focus on these important platonic relationships, and that's just what I love to read and write.
It also is for me as well. Like, Radio Silence was my first book of yours that I read, and I was just like, yes! Fists in air, shaking happy. It was so good.
Yay.
And I suppose that sort of is interesting that, yes, there is a massive focus of in YA on romance and things like that. And there's also, for writers as well, there's a lot of resources that talk about how to write a successful romance or how to write a romance story. I'm sort of wondering, how would you go about writing a really good on-the-page friendship, as you have done successfully in so many different works? What makes a good friendship to write?
Honestly, I have thought about this, and I think the advice is so similar to writing a good romance. Like, you know, chemistry is so important, you know, building up rather than just jumping straight in, instantly best friends, building up to it. Like, so for me, in Loveless, one of the main relationships in the book is between Georgia and her roommate, Rooney, and they're so different. I wanted this to be almost like a classic romance setup. You've got two people who are very different.
That love-hate relationship.
Yeah, exactly. They're not really sure about each other. Like, they
friends
don't have...
enemies to friends to lovers sort of start.
Exactly,
just enemies,
yeah.
Friends,
exactly. So it is kind of like a similar structure of a relationship. And I just don't think there's that much different when you're trying to write a really convincing relationship, apart from just not doing the romance bit. So
I suppose there is this misconception that romance is more than friendship, but when you sort of come down to it, it's all about, you know, communication, having stuff you sort of challenge but also complement each other. Any sort of relationship works like that. What have been some of your favorite friendships, I suppose, in other media that sort of inspired you or made you feel warm?
Oh my gosh. Oh, that's a really difficult question. Oh, no, I've got one. I don't know if this is available to watch in Australia, but I recently watched a TV show called I May Destroy You. It sounds really good. It's a really, really good drama about like trauma. At the center of it, yay, cheerful. It's really, really good. If you like things like Fleabag, Russian Doll, Netflix, it's very similar to those. But at the heart of it, it's got this really amazing friendship between these two girls. I've just never seen a show that really celebrated a friendship in that way, and it almost was like a love story, their friendship. So I'd recommend that. And I always think as well, just something completely different, but Six of Crows by Leigh Bardugo. It's just like the classic found family book for me. Like, it's got this like group
found
of misfits
family.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the best thing to ever happen to literature in general, family.
Yes, agreed.
And I think as queer people, we just hug onto found family so much, because for so many of us, that is our families and the families we make.
That's so true.
It's such a unique experience to see reflected in fiction. And you really do see it in the case of Loveless. Like, the whole entire time I was reading, I just wanted to take Sunil and just give them a big hug and just be like, you're everything to me. Can we expect any sort of maybe a little mini comic or something of the Loveless crew?
I would love to. Honestly, I could easily write a short story about any of the main characters from Loveless. I just fell in love with all of them.
You've sort of talked a little bit in past interviews and things how the way you sort of came at sort of things like Heartstopper and more of your writing craft was that you just wanted to get your characters on the page and like visualize them and actually see them. Is that sort of part of your writing process in general, even if the work itself, like Loveless, isn't necessarily a graphic novel?
Yeah, definitely. I think like my books are so, they're all very character focused, and I always start with the characters, and that's like the main thing I like to write about, way more than coming up with a really in like super crazy plot or anything like that. Or it's all about writing characters and relationships and just falling in love with those characters and relationships.
I sometimes have the tendency to, I'm quite similar in that the characters come first. It's like, great, here's 30,000 words of them around having tea.
Yes.
Talking about their trauma.
Yeah, that's definitely me.
Sort of marrying the your art and your writing is one of your soon to be newly released, maybe by the time this podcast is out, currently released, so go buy it. Nick and Charlie book, which is amazing because we're revisiting the Heartstopper boys and the Solitaire boys. How did that sort of happen, that you wanted to combine the two forms?
Well, it kind of just, I don't even know how it happened really. Like the story came out ages ago. It was first published as an ebook in 2015, which is so long ago.
Oh God, it's 2020.
I know.
Not to date this podcast, but
yeah. So, people have really enjoyed that story, and I think a lot of new people have been finding it because Heartstopper has been doing quite well. And so my publisher were like, "Well, why don't we publish it in paperback?" And then they, you know, I've been talking, because I have different publishers for my prose novels and for Heartstopper. And I'm always trying to sort of get them to work together. So
come on, be Avengers.
Be friends.
Yes, be friends.
So I think because of that, they sort of wanted to combine Heartstopper with this Nick and Charlie story and appeal to readers of my prose novels and readers of Heartstopper. And I'm so happy with how it looks. Like, I've always wanted to have a illustrated bit of prose, so
I mean, from what I've been seeing online, it looks very gorgeous.
Yeah.
And has that beautiful pastel sort of colouring that all your books have.
Yes.
That's such a great choice. It looks so good on my shelves. We sort of talked a lot about how, like, just in general, lovely Lovelace is, but it also tackles some of the, I'm not going to say darker, but some of the harder elements of being aromantic and asexual, particularly in terms of aromantics and asexuals and araces being discriminated against by other members of the queer community. I was wondering, how important was it for you to include some of these more uncomfortable and realistic struggles of being arrow, being ace, being arrow ace into this novel of Lovelace?
Yeah, something I thought, I mean, I gave a lot of thought to it because on the one hand, you know, I wanted this story to be uplifting and empowering for arrow and ace people. And, you know, I was like, oh, well, in that case, maybe I shouldn't focus too much on the negative experiences, like, I'm not sure, but on the other hand, I did want people to see their experiences in the book and even the bad experiences and feel that those experiences, you know, they happen, and especially for people who aren't arrow ace to understand that arrow ace people do experience some quite specific forms of discrimination. So I did want to include the sort of classic exclusionist person who, like, I think...
The one we root against.
Yes, exactly. Like, that's such a very specific problem that I think arrow ace people have to deal with online especially. I wanted to include it, but also sort of show the characters, like, really overcoming this person and just showing how wrong it is. So, yeah, it was all about getting a balance.
Showing that reality that there's far more supporters than there are sort of online naysayers. Or
exactly.
I think that's a really important element of coming out stories for young queer people, is to sort of know, yes, it's going to be hard, but it's going to be worthwhile in the end.
Yeah.
A sort of another element that you really, that really did, again, show that this was an own voices novel, was George's own sort of mourning or grieving period for that, that heteronormative dream that she sort of always envisioned herself having. Which is something I'm sure that a lot of other aromantic and asexual people also experience. I know I experienced it myself. But I was wondering, what sort of role do you hope that Lovelace in general, by showing such real experiences of aromantic and asexual people, will have in combating this heteronormative narrative?
I mean, hopefully it'll help people. Firstly, I wanted it to show to arrow ace people that it's okay to not feel okay at first, if that makes sense. Because when I was first finding out about aromanticism and asexuality, all I saw were people who were super positive about it. They love being arrow ace. And I was sitting there like, I don't feel this way. Like, what's wrong with me? Why don't I feel good about this yet? So I wanted to show that experience, but I also wanted to, you know, the journey of the book is her having those feelings and then, you know, coming to realise that she has all these amazing relationships around her and she's going to be okay. Like, so, yeah.
I mean, without spoiling too much of the book, that sort of end, that part towards the end where she sort of feels open enough to be able to joke about her own identity. There's so much, especially in sort of an Australian culture, there's so much power in being able to laugh at yourself.
Yeah.
That it was a really fantastic moment to see just how far Georgia comes and still will go with her own identity. Sort of in a more real world setting, you yourself have actually talked a bit about some of the difficulties you had with writing Lovelace. So I was wondering if you could go a little bit more into sort of what initial difficulties you had, either in the drafting stage or as publication crept closer and closer, like the looming monster it is.
This was a very difficult book to write. I started planning it pretty much immediately after I Was Born for This came out, which was in May 2018. And I immediately, you know, I had a two-book deal at that point, so I had to write another book. And I knew I wanted it to be sort of vaguely about, like, friendships being just as important as romance. And then that sort of evolved into this coming out story. But my issue was that I just couldn't plot it. Like, I could not figure out. I knew I wanted what sort of the central journey of the main character to be, but actually creating a plot around that was just so difficult, and I'm not even sure why, honestly. I struggled so much, and this carried on for like a year, like solid year of just not really being able to figure out how I was gonna craft this story. And eventually, you know, my deadlines were creeping closer and closer. Like the book was supposed to come out last summer, and so my deadlines were supposed to be a lot earlier, and I've missed them all. I just had to start drafting, like, not knowing how the story was going to end. I didn't really like feel confident in my plan or anything like that. I was just like, oh god, my deadlines are coming, I just need to start writing this book, which was a terrible idea. I am not the sort of person who can write without a plan. I really need to know what I'm doing. But I did it anyway. I started, I got up to about 60,000 words. And this was in like, I can't remember when this was. This was either like end of last year or like beginning of this year. And I realized I just didn't like it. I just did not like anything.
After 60,000 words.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I was just so unhappy with it. There were some key elements of it that I did like. I wasn't just going to scrap it all. But I was talking to one of my writer friends, and she was like, you just need to start again. You need to like go back to the beginning and start again, because this is not good.
I'm getting like secondhand stress. Right? I know it's like in your past, but I'm feeling it all right now.
Oh, it was not good. So I did that. I started again, and I recycled a lot of what I'd already written. So it wasn't like a complete rewrite, but I went back. I spent like a solid week completely planning the whole thing and just making sure I had a solid plan from beginning to end. I knew where the story was going. And then after that, I was able to write a first draft, finally. it was all just very, very cutting it close. I had a first draft early this year, and it had to be done by like May, I think. So we didn't have a lot of time to edit. Oh, it was very stressful.
With everything going on currently, it's so great that something beautiful came out after so much turmoil. Yeah. That sort of leads me to ask you, as a multidisciplinarian, I suppose, what is the difference between drawing a comic that doesn't work or writing something like Loveless in that first draft that doesn't work?
Mm. Yeah, with the comics, so with Heartstopper, it is so much harder to go back and change things. You really can't. you really just can't. I mean, I could, if I really wanted to, go back and like redraw whole chunks of it, but that would take so much time. So I try not to do that. To be fair, I plan Heartstopper in a lot more detail. I think there's a lot bigger of a planning process. It's not just planning the plot. I plan the plot, and then I sort of plan individual scenes, and then I write the scene, and then I draw. So there's a lot of stuff to get through before I get to the drawing stage. And usually if there's any like plot issues or things I think need editing, that can happen before I even get to the drawing stage.
In the thumbnail stage, when they're just stick figures with eyes.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm actually curious, is Heartstopper for you a matter of drawing in grey lead and then coming to it with digital drawing later, or do you just draw straight onto like a tablet or something?
I draw straight onto, no one will see this, so I can't show you, but
it's just for me.
I draw straight onto my laptop. I use a Wacom sort of graphics tablet.
I've been pronouncing it Wacom.
Is it Wacom? I don't know.
I don't think there's don't come to me for pronunciation. I'm just saying
Wacom would
not
make
the
more
best.
Sense, actually.
Wacom?
Wacom. It doesn't sound as good to say. So I just draw straight into Photoshop with that. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. I use Procreate on my
I use that as well
iPad,
sometimes.
Which
yeah.
works really well.
That's good. Yeah.
It sort of gets me wondering, with Heartstopper, like you sort of said, since it's very much a you governed thing, it began as a webcomic, which awesome, love webcomics.
Yeah.
Did you find that by originally self-publishing Heartstopper in that way that you were given a lot more freedom to be able to be a bit more experimental? You didn't have those deadlines, that sort of thing? Mm.
Definitely. Like, it started as just my own project for fun that I just wanted to do because I wanted to do it. I didn't have to answer to anyone. You know, no one was giving me editorial notes for it. There were no deadlines. I could really control everything about it, which I really liked. And one of my worries when Heartstopper did get picked up for publication was that that control would sort of go away. But it really hasn't. Like, it's still very much my project. So my publisher helped me a lot with designing the book and marketing the book, but in terms of the actual story and stuff, that's all still in my control, which is why I want it.
That's the best way to have it, to keep it
yes.
close.
Yes.
No one can touch this. Has your creative approach to Heartstopper sort of changed since its initial inception to now that it is, that you know it's eventually going to be out into the world as a more physical thing?
Yeah, actually, this is something I've been talking about a little bit recently. Because Heartstopper, being a webcomic originally, it really didn't matter how long the chapters were. They could just be as long as they needed to be.
I feel now, that as a fan fiction writer.
Yeah. But now, like, there's going to be 5 Heartstopper books, and they really can't be longer than, like, 400 pages each. If they're longer than that, they'll be difficult to read and really expensive to make, so they really can't be much longer than that. So I have to keep that in mind all the time while I'm writing and planning the story, to make sure that everything that goes in there is important and what I really want to be in there, and I'm not wasting any pages putting stuff in there that I don't really care about.
Those can be special bonus deleted scenes.
Yes, exactly.
It's a bit hard being a teen carrying the gay version of War and Peace onto the bus.
So true.
It gets me thinking that what was it about Nick and Charlie's story that said I needed to be seen, I needed to be drawn, rather than, say, George's story with Loveless and needing to be read?
Mm. Yeah, I actually... When I first knew I wanted to tell Nick and Charlie's story, I did try to plan it as a novel, but it just didn't work. I think because so I wanted to tell their like origin story and how, because this is back when, for a bit of context for people who don't know, Nick and Charlie were characters in my first YA novel, Solitaire, which came out in 2014. They were secondary characters in that story, but we don't really learn much about them in that story. So I wanted to tell kind of how they got together and how they reached the point where they're at in Solitaire and kind of what happens after that. So it's quite a long period of time of their lives to tell. And it also doesn't really follow like a classic novel structure. So in a novel, you've got like the character or relationship journey that sort of goes like that over the course of the book. But Nick and Charlie's story isn't like that. It's more made up of sort of episodes, I would call them, like periods vignettes of time. Yeah, sort of things that happen in their lives. It's very much sort of an ongoing story. There's no like broad sweeping arc across the whole thing. So that lends itself much more to an episodic story like a webcomic rather than a novel. And also I just love drawing. So
it's a good excuse to put down the keyboard for a while and get out the, I was about to say the pen. I don't know.
Exactly.
which, to be honest, there's so many beautiful sections in Heartstopper that I think would be really hard to translate to prose. There's just many the longing look or the side eye sort of stare. And actually there's, or not actually, of course there is, but there's so really deeply emotional scenes in Heartstopper. I'm wondering how, as a storyteller, do you sort of gauge if whether a drawing that you're doing or a scene that you're doing is getting that sort of right emotional response from a reader, or do you just sort of, if you cry, then you think a reader's going to cry over the Wacom?
Yeah. I think it's like knowing it's kind of an instinctual thing. Like I grew up reading a lot of comics, and particularly I read a lot of manga.
Like shonen manga with
pedals. Yeah, beautiful. exactly like classic romance. And from that I think I really learned how to express emotion through the comic form, and it's something that I found really difficult to explain how you do it, because it's all about like angles and which what you choose to show in each panel and the spacing of the panels and all of that combines together to get that sort of emotional response from a reader. And it is so difficult to explain how it's done, but it's quite similar to sort of film like camera work, I suppose.
There's a cinematography to it.
Exactly. And the only way to really learn how to do it, I think, is to just read a lot of comics.
Learn the language of comics to be like, oh, that upward shot means exactly that person is inferior or something.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Either in sort of the case of Heartstopper graphic novels or in the case of Loveless, do you have a favorite part of the publishing process?
Or a
most despised part? I won't tell your publishers.
Oh my gosh. My favorite part, I think, is when I see the book, for my prose novels anyway, when I see them typeset for the first time, so when they actually look like the real book, that's when it all starts to feel really real. That's really fun. But what's my least favorite?
Still in the tea with Alice. We can rename the podcast.
No, I know exactly what it is. It's after I've done the first draft, it's when I get back the first set of editorial notes from my editor, and every time it takes me ages to read it, ages to even open it, because I'm like, oh god, I don't want to read all this criticism of my work.
Are you worried there's going to be just a big X that says, start again?
This is bad, cut this character. No.
I suppose that is a terribly common feel for both established and emerging writers and artists as well, just that deep criticism from editing, which almost always makes the work better, let's be honest.
Yes, exactly.
We may have a grieving period, but we'll get over it and it actually makes better.
Yeah.
What's sort of your advice to young writers and young artists wanting to work similarly to you? What's your advice to them when engaging with criticism?
I think trying to write something just for you. Don't write something that you're relying on other people's criticism and feelings about. Write something that is just yours, that you just love to write. Because I think as soon as you start worrying about what other people are going to think of it, that's when the process gets so much more stressful. And I don't think that makes it an impossible thing to do, but if you're just doing it for you to start off with, I think that's it it's a lot easier at the start anyway. But in terms of dealing with criticism, I guess like learning the distinction between helpful criticism and not helpful criticism. So people, you know, if someone's being like super, super harsh or, you know, I'm just thinking of fan fiction as an example, like if the comments that if there's just a really, really nasty comment, like understand that that's not a sensible thing that you should take on board. But that, you know, positive criticism could be helpful. So yeah,
even if that positive criticism is just like a keyboard smash on fanfiction, particularly if I get that comment, I know I've done a good job. I'm like, yes,
yeah.
Incoherency.
Yes.
Sort of adjacent to the topic of criticism, but more in a publishing industry way. The emergence of own voices, which for those who don't know, own voices started as a hashtag that sort of spoke to writers writing characters or writing stories based on their own experiences, mostly experiences with marginalizations. So with this emergence of own voices being so prevalent in publishing, a lot of authors have been feeling the need to sort of disclose or the pressure to disclose their varying identities, some identities which aren't necessarily immediate to the eye, like queerness or mental health status. There's a lot of pressure behind that for authors. I'm sort of wondering, as an author yourself, what are your thoughts on this, or have you had any experiences with feeling that pressure?
Yeah, I think it's a really difficult issue because on the one hand, own voices is so good for kind of uplifting people's own experiences and books that are very true to the author's experience, and that's a really good thing. But on the other hand, you know, people have felt pressure to share things that they might not otherwise want to share online. I only started sharing online about being Arrowace when Loveless sort of came out. Well, not really came out, but a little bit before. And part of that was because I wanted people to know that it was like a genuine experience. It's difficult because that can kind of be like abused in a way by, you know, forcing people to disclose things that they really don't feel comfortable, and you know, people getting criticized and until they reveal certain things about themselves, it's a really difficult issue, and I'm not really sure what the solution is to that. It's difficult.
It is difficult, and it's understandable sometimes when readers come at it from a place of love. They want to sort of feel a safety with the author if they're speaking about something quite sensitive or writing about something quite sensitive. So I can understand that desire. I can't imagine how difficult it would be to sort of expose that part of yourself to a wider platform.
I wouldn't want any author to feel like they had to share stuff, but I understand why people would want that. It's hard.
it's one of those grey areas of publishing. Yeah. We're all working together to sort of figure out and do what's best for both authors and young readers.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of feeding onto that, I know we're getting into some sort of more deep publishing concerns and questions. I'm just curious though. Heartstopper has been such a massive, massive, massive success, deservedly so, because it's a beautiful story, beautiful drawings, beautiful writing. But some people have not critiqued it per se, but put it in the category of other stories that are about gay cis men but not being written by a gay cis man, which has sort of become an emerging prevalency in publishing in general. I was wondering if you could sort of speak to whether or not you feel that this culture of eroticizing or fetishizing cis gay men has changed queer depictions in media at all, or our expectations of that, with the caveat of me saying that I don't think that that's what Heartstopper is at all.
Yeah, no, it's something I've been very aware of since way before I started Heartstopper, because it's and such a problem in the world of webcomics.
Yeah.
That, like, it's really, really bad. There are so many webcomics about, you know, cis gay men that are just there to, for people's kind of sexual enjoyment, which is so awful.
Mm.
And I knew from the very start, I really did not want Heartstopper to be anything like that. I don't know what else to say about that, really.
Don't do it. I sort of think that it's definitely a valid criticism for just in general of the fetishizing and eroticizing of cis gay men. My sort of view is that the best thing that a lot of us can do is to uplift cis gay men telling their own stories. So I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for YA readers who might enjoy Heartstopper but also be keen to branch out.
Yes.
So
firstly, I want to tell you about Simon James Green, who is a British author who writes gay YA for it's kind of borderline MGYA, sort of right in the middle there.
That's a good demographic.
They're so good. They're so funny. They're hilarious, firstly. They're like proper comedies. They're romances as well, but they're really funny. And they're just like, if you want to read something that's just so heartwarming and will just take you like out of your head if you're having a stressful day, Simon James Green is great. Secondly, if you like Heartstopper and you want more graphic novels, I would recommend Bloom by Kevin Panetta. I have that.
Yes. I'm pointing. People can't see, but I'm pointing at my bookshelf. It's so good.
And has a very similar vibe to Heartstopper. So if you want more graphic novels, that is a really good one. Lastly, I just have to say a classic, which is Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, which is by Benjamin Elias Sainz, and is one of my favourite, I think, YA novels ever. It's so good. It's really beautiful sort of coming out story. I wrote my dissertation on some of it at university.
Wow.
It was, yeah, I love it.
I've got to go back to uni if I can write about some of my favorite books. That's awesome. That's incredible. Sort of maybe feeding on from that, has there been any stories or artwork that it has inspired Loveless?
Yes, I have to shout out Summer Bird Blue, which is by Akemi Dawn Bowman. It's a YA novel. It's about grief, but the main character throughout the story is kind of questioning whether she is on the aromantic or asexual spectrums. It's really good. I think that was the first book I read which had a protagonist who was actually like questioning whether they were aromantic or asexual rather than just being confident in their identity. So I really appreciate it.
Straight
that.
Into acceptance.
Yes.
That's so awesome. I'm definitely going to have to look that up because that sounds entirely up my alley.
Yes.
Sort of jumping a bit because I'm looking at the clock. So you sort of said that some other things that have influenced your work has been this gorgeous anime series called Digimon.
Yes.
You said that it actually in an interview, you said that it has influenced you as more as a person than any other piece of media, which is a powerful
statement.
Yeah, I
stand by that. I think that's true.
I was wondering if you could tell us a bit how that is the case, and also since Digimon, for those who don't know, it's all about the friendship between humans, these digi-destined, and these digital monsters that become their life partners in a sense. It's very platonic in that sense. I'm wondering if in general, obviously you love romance and you love love, but do you find yourself gravitating sometimes to more platonic stories or more platonic characters and relationships?
Yeah. I think that might have been what really drew me to that as a child. Like, I was never really into like Disney, like
romances that much. I liked them, but I wasn't like super obsessed. But I was super obsessed with Digimon.
Understandably.
Yeah. No, I think when I say that it influenced me as a person more than anything else, I think it just the way it told the story and the way it developed the main cast of characters has just been like the foundation for how I write stories and the sort of stories that I like to write. Because even as a young child, I remember just caring so deeply about these characters and understanding them as they sort of learn new things about themselves and kind of had this character development. I feel like Digimon really had so much character development for what is just a children's show.
It really got in deep to the friendship dynamics and that idea again of found family. They all only had each other to look out for each other. So
yeah, I just love it.
Do you have a favorite character from Digimon?
Oh my gosh. I think
who would be your partner, Digimon?
Oh. I think Gatomon was my favorite. Yeah.
After watching the first movie and like the first series, I was just like, oh my god, Gatomon. And like evolving into Angelmon, I'm like, yes.
Exactly. Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
I think I had bit of a crush on some of the Digimon. Now that I'm older, I look back and I'm like, oh. That's so good. But jumping from Digimon straight back into all that serious talk. That's how we do it here on the Sydney Writers Festival podcast.
Yeah.
Since we're talking so much about Loveless, which again, I loved Loveless, I'm sort of feeding back into that idea of it being you drawing upon your own experiences and you yourself being an own voices author in this sense. Everyone knows that saying to write what you know. It's often advice that young writers are given. I was wondering how much of your own personal narrative do you juggle when taking inspiration from your own life and from perhaps people or experiences that you yourself have had?
So I think with Loveless, I picked out a lot of sort of specific experiences that I've had. But the thing about real life is that it rarely has like a very clean narrative.
Unfortunately.
I really admire people who can write a good like autobiography and make a story out of their own life, because like I could not do that.
They've got to be faking it.
Yeah, surely. No, but so I picked out some specific experiences, but it was crafting Loveless is about sort of fitting those into a wider sort of story that makes sense and has a clearer journey.
That's so interesting. Sorry, my cat's attacking my leg. I was sort of wondering if you could sort of speak a little bit about how you sort of interwove this idea of one of the greatest, that's debatable, but one of the greatest writers of love stories, Shakespeare, into Loveless. How did that come about? Did you have quite a big theatre background?
I did. I did a lot of theatre while I was at school. I was always in the school plays. I went to a youth theatre until I was like 17, I think. And like Georgia, at that point, I started to feel like very anxious about performing. I just like weirdly, I really enjoyed theatre. And then I got to a point where I was like, I hate doing this. Why am I doing this? theatre's sort of been a part of my life for quite a long time. And I also just love Shakespeare. Shakespeare was one of the few things I really enjoyed learning about at uni.
Really?
Yeah.
Sorry, I said that incredulously.
No, it was. Like, I did not enjoy a lot of my degree. I did English literature, and a lot of it I found extremely boring. but there was a Shakespeare module and a Shakespeare on film module, and those two, like, because I could literally, for both of them, I would just watch the Shakespeares on, like, YouTube and whatever. And I just, particularly the comedies, I just love them. I just think they're so much fun. So when I was coming up with Loveless, I knew I wanted theatre to be a part of it. So I decided to put Shakespeare in there just because it's something that I enjoy. I thought it would be fun. I think, yeah, it's great.
It fits so seamlessly, which is so interesting to think when you said you had such difficulty plotting Loveless in terms of writing craft and the actual plot and structure of it. It flows so seamlessly through these ideas of theatre and performance, which I guess speaks to the performance a lot of us our ACE people do trying to navigate this heteronormative world.
Yes.
That was totally intentional.
That was you so good. Take that.
I think I just have one last thing I sort of want to chat with you a bit about before we have to end for the day, because otherwise we could just keep going on and on about our favourite Digimon arcs.
Yes.
Next time. I sort of want to touch into something that's probably really relevant for our times right now, but also I expect probably when this podcast comes out, is that because writing feels like it's never been more important, more inclusive, and more experimental than ever, I suppose, what role do you think that fiction aimed at a YA audience plays, if any, in this evolving landscape that we're in?
That is a very deep, difficult question.
Unironic dab.
Well, I mean, I like fiction for so many different reasons. I think right now it's great to have an escape from what's happening, just to have, you know, a little bit of time to escape into a book or a TV show or a film. And I've lots of my friends who aren't big readers have actually been reading a lot just because of everything that's happening, and it's a nice way to sort of get out of the world for a little bit, I suppose.
It's so much easier to deal with dragons and swords.
Yes,
and
exactly. But it's also, you know, YA fiction right now, I think, is making so much progress in terms of uplifting marginalized stories and marginalized creators. Like, there's a lot of work to be done, but I feel really, like, excited by what's going on at the moment and how many books are being published that are being told by marginalized authors. I think that's only going to continue to grow over the next few years. And yeah, it's very exciting.
Oh, I'm terribly excited to see not only what comes out of this sort of renaissance of YA, but what comes from you next. So any secret little plugs or surprises?
Secrets? Yes. I'm currently working on edits for my next novella. So after Nick and Charlie, we're also publishing my other novella, which originally came out in 2015, this winter. That is coming out in October.
Is there going to be illustrations, perhaps?
Perhaps.
Ooh, you heard it here first, folks. The
yes.
Oh, that's so exciting. No, well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, Alison. Again, thank you so much for coming all the way down here to Australia to chat with me today.
Thank you for having me.
No, thank you so much. By the time this comes out, everyone should already be on the ball and have grabbed Loveless from their closest independent bookstore. Like dogs, all bookstores are good, so all good bookstores will have Loveless. Also, while you're at it, grab Charlie and Nick as well, which comes out on August
6th.
I put you on the spot there. I'm sorry.
I hope that's right.
We'll fix it in post. It'll be fine. Yeah. So thank you again. Thank you so much again, Alice, for chatting with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And everyone, enjoy the rest of your Sydney Writers Festival podcasting.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.